Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. This morning, we'll hear part one of a two-part program about the Habitat Conservation Plan in Oregon State Forests. We'll explore what the HCP is, the mandate behind it, how it was developed, and how it will roll out. To help us understand the complex Habitat Conservation Plan and its purposes, our guest is Michael Wilson. Mike is the division chief in charge of the state forests for the Oregon Department of Forestry.
So, Mike, welcome to you, and thanks for being willing to talk with us.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you this afternoon.
So, to begin with, can we hear a little about your background and your role in the department?
Sure. Well, I started out my career as a biologist and actually worked with threatened and endangered species quite a lot, including northern spotted owls on Oregon Department of Forestry lands. Back in the day, we were contracted through OSU as surveyors for both research and operational purposes. So I've got quite a bit of field experience with a lot of the species that we're dealing with here in this HCP. But I formally came to the department in 1995, basically to manage a lot of the threatened and endangered species data and also the survey contracts and other things as well. Spent many years in technical positions in the State Forest Division, and I recently found myself in this position after a few years of moving up through the management chain.
Well, can you tell us how the Habitat Conservation Plan came about? Now, there's a federal mandate behind it, isn't there?
Yeah, and if I can take a few minutes with this, I'll try to be as brief as possible, but I think there's probably a lot of folks who aren't that familiar with what habitat conservation plans are, and they kind of read it in and make some assumptions in the words of it. But the main issue is what's called take of species that are listed as threatened and endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act, or ESA, as we call it. And so take is defined as to harass, harm, hunt, pursue, shoot, wound, kill, all kinds of things like that, right? Or to attempt to engage in any of that conduct. And non-federal land managers like ODF are prohibited from taking threatened and endangered species, even if that take is from an otherwise legal activity like logging. So for instance, we don't go out and try to kill a northern spotted owl, but if we accidentally cut down habitat and that harms the owl, it's still a take. And there's no exception for that under that provision of the ESA. So we try to do that. We implement for years and years now, over 30 years, we have implemented a costly survey and manage approach, where we conduct surveys to try to establish that species are absent before we go through and do an operation. And if they are there, we apply certain protection measures. And while we think those protection measures are great, there is no guarantee that they will stand up in court. And there's no guarantee, quite frankly, that they're 100% successful. You could miss a species. It just go undetected. Your protection measures might not be good enough. So that's where HCPs come in. Under the Section 10 of the Endangered Species Act, you can get what's called an incidental take permit. So it's recognized up front that the activities that you're doing are going to take some of these individuals of the species. But in exchange for that, you provide conservation measures that offset that take. There's a few different avenues to an incidental take permit. They're kind of similar, but in this case, an HCP is the one that's appropriate. So there's this deal that's struck essentially between the federal services. And when we say services, we mean the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, also known as NOAA Fisheries, that have jurisdiction over the protection of these species under the ESA. So you strike a deal with the services there where it's found that, yeah, your conservation measures are adequate to offset the take that you will, in fact, incur. So An HCP is a really smart decision from that standpoint because it takes away that legal risk, which mostly comes in from third-party lawsuits who come in and allege that your protection measures are not good enough, or whatever, your survey and manage program isn't good enough. And this isn't our first attempt. We've had an HCP before on the Elliott State Forest. That was from 1995 through about 2001. And then we tried to add fish to that and update some things about it. That fell through. And the legal challenge on the Elliott was ultimately over murrelets. And that was what, caused us to have to go back and reconsider our take avoidance policies in that context. In the meantime, other things happened where the Elliott was taken out from under our management. But that's the kind of lawsuit that we're trying to avoid. More recently, we were sued over alleged take of coho salmon for a lot of our North Coast area. And we entered into a settlement agreement recently, and a large part of that is hooked to this HCP and the fact that we're doing it. So we'd had various attempts also on our Western Oregon State Forest over the years. We tried to get an HCP early on. It just never quite worked out. And looking at the lessons learned from that, we went into this process eyes wide open. And so I'd like to touch a little bit now how this was developed. So the first thing we did was we really established some very clear governance up front. And so we have a scoping team of technical staff from the federal services and from state agencies. So that includes ODF, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA Fisheries, ODFW, DEQ, DSL, Department of State Lands, and OSU, also in an advisory capacity on that scoping team as well. And those are the folks that worked on the technical aspects of it. And then we also had a steering committee made up of decision makers, of leadership from those same agencies. To provide direction to the scoping team and also to resolve any issues that the scoping team could not come to agreement on. And I'm glad to say, actually, that the scoping team was able to work out almost all of the things. And the steering committee didn't have to engage that way. So it was a really productive process from the bottom up. In addition, we had extensive public engagement planned and carried out with a lot of meetings open to the public. Individual meetings with various stakeholder groups, and of course, many Board of Forestry meetings where this has been an issue over the last couple of years, for sure. So, and in all of that, except for the Board of Forestry meetings themselves, the process was very well facilitated and supported. So, we had the bones of the process in place. In terms of the actual work that we did, that really mostly took place within the scoping team. And so, we started out by just working to identify and confirm the covered species that we would have, that we would include. And there were certain criteria applied to those. For instance, are they listed or are they likely to become listed? Do they occur on our lands? Are the activities we're proposing actually likely to incur take of those species? Do we know enough about the species to provide to design a protection measure, a conservation action to offset the take? And so from that, we ended up with a list of 17 species, and there was 10 fish. Let's see. Make sure I get my numbers right here, but it's 10 fish, 3 salamanders, 2 birds, and 2 mammals. So it's a pretty comprehensive list. It's a pretty robust HCP. And that's why the conservation measures look like they do. And I'll get to that in a minute or two. Once we had identified those species and which ones should be included, we identified all of the covered activities that might take them. And that's part of the HCP as well. As a matter of fact, if you walk through the HCP chapter by chapter, it kind of goes through a lot of these things. We identified the covered activities that we wanted the take permits to apply to. Things like timber harvest, road building, recreation, infrastructure development, and the things that we didn't want it to apply to. For instance, the actual people recreating themselves. I mean, we can't control everything that people do, but we can control how we develop our infrastructure to make sure that it's not that it applies certain conservation actions to that. Once we did that, we really started developing conservation strategies. And the first step was to define biological goals and objectives for each species. So those basically would have been increasing, for instance, increasing, maintain, and increase the amount of suitable habitat for X species. And the actual amount of that habitat wasn't really defined at that time. We just said, okay, that's the direction of these goals and objectives that we're trying to do. The numeric values came later, really, after we had gone through a lot of the nuts and bolts of the conservation measures and were able to do some modeling, forest activity modeling that showed what potential habitat outcomes look like, both in terms of habitat growth and habitat that we would take as part of our covered activities. As we develop those conservation actions, the first thing that we would do is sit down as a group with the scoping team and really talk about the science that we could bring to bear on that. Like, for instance, what do we know about how water heats up in a clear-cut unit, say, and then cools back down within a stream-buffered area or within a forested area? Or, what do we know about historic species occurrence on from all of the surveys that we've done on our lands? And from that, we were able to then design some conservation measures, bring them, and ODF was in the driver's seat of proposing a specific, say, stream buffer width or something like that, bringing it to the scoping team. And then we would discuss any issues and concerns and determine whether or not there were changes to be made. And sometimes there were changes to be made. And then sometimes the things were kind of nebulous, maybe. And it's kind of like, well, that sounds like we'll figure it out when we do the take analysis. And so that is part of it, right? Part of this is, that is the point of it, is to incur some incidental take. And so we don't have to actually protect every, specific location or accommodate every potential point where we might take a species. So after basically doing that, we conducted a lot of modeling exercises to get the idea of what the effects would be, the habitat effects. And from then we were able to go back to those biological goals and objectives and put some numbers in there. And in those numbers that we put in there, we also, for lack of a better term, we hedged our bets a little, because while a forest model might say, yeah, you're going to be able to grow all this habitat, we're like, maybe conditions will be that we can't grow all that habitat. There might be climate change effects, other disturbance effects that just keep us from getting to that goal. So we made sure that we were able to numbers that we felt safe with. And then we basically finalize the final piece. There are components of adaptive monitoring and adaptive management, and how we would respond to circumstances that we could reasonably foresee, such as large fires, based on our large fire history, over the last, well, since we've been managing the lands. And so we included the 2020 Labor Day fires in there as well. Say, well, if we get fires that, looking at that average, that do this, we'll respond in this way. But the nice thing is, if something really unforeseen happens, it's kind of like, wow, we really didn't see this coming in the next 70 years. We're not required to do anything above and beyond what we said we would do for that threshold that we identified for disturbance. And that's part of the whole thing with the services, is that, a deal is a deal. Here's the conservation actions. Here's the things we can reasonably foresee and accommodate. Here's the take you think we're going to incur. And as long as we follow the conditions of this HCP, then the permit, the incidental take permit, can't be taken away from us by the feds. If it's not working out for us and we can't figure out a way to come to a resolution on that with them, then we can always walk away from it. The applicant, in this case, ODF, can choose to walk away from it, but the feds can't take it away from us. There's a little bit of a caveat to that, of course. If we've gone down the road and we've incurred a bunch of this take, right? Say halfway through the permit period, and maybe we haven't had all the mitigation we thought we would have for it. Well, then we have to deal with how do we deal with that unmitigated component of take that we have. But I don't think that's really a big risk for us. I think we're going to find it. We can work pretty well with the services.
What's the status now of the HCP? It has been approved by the Board of Forestry. And so what happens next? Do you have to pass it before the other agencies, the federal agencies that need to approve it still?
That's right. So what the board actually did in March was they approved for us to continue with the current draft. What that means is we're trying very hard to get pencils down on that draft so the services, the feds, can actually finish their work. It's in the NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act process currently, and has been for quite a while. And so they just need to know we're at a point where we have stopped making any kind of changes to it, and they can do all of the analysis that they need to do to ensure that it meets sufficient criteria, that it's sufficient for them to issue these incidental take permits. So we're expecting to be pencils down on it very soon. And I am hopeful that we will have our incidental take permits no later than sometime next spring. Of course, it all boils down to the capacity of the federal services to be able to do all the work, issue their biological opinions for the species in question, and just wrap up all that work. And, you know, I want to say that the services have been really good partners in this process. I mean, of course, we always have concerns and issues to, you know, debate back and forth, but they've been very upfront and very good in their dealings. And they do have capacity issues. You know, they're dealing with two other big prominent HCPs as well, one for the Elliott State Forest and one for the Private Forest Accord. So, and that's just the HCP part of their work. So they're pretty busy, that's for sure.
Well, the local entities that receive money from state forests, I mean, their focus right now is on how much are we going to lose and so on. When does that start to happen? Is that immediate or is that once this is federally approved, or what? I guess what happens now is the basic question I want to ask you.
It will start to happen over the next couple of years. We'll start to really see the effects of it. So our timber sale contracts typically last 3 years, about that. And a lot of times the harvest doesn't necessarily take place up front in those timber sales. The purchaser of the sale has some wiggle room in there. And that's good to give them that flexibility for a variety of logistical reasons. So, you know, if you think about sales that are being harvested right now, a lot of those are still coming from our fiscal year 2022, fiscal year 2023 sales. Starting with fiscal 2024, which started last July 1, we've been selling less timber because it complies with the draft HCP strategies. And the reason that we planned it that way was, you know, well, quite frankly, one of the reasons we thought we would have incidental take permits by now originally. So we were, in terms of how we have to do our planning, we can't just have something land in the middle of our planning cycle and then have to adjust. So timber sales that are going to have to be compliant with the conservation actions of the HCP, they need to already be set up that way. So we did see, we have a volume for the portion of our ODF lands that are within the HCP permit area, we typically planned and sold an average of 215 million board feet over the last 10 years. That's a decent average to use. Whereas under the HCP, it's more around 183, 185 million. So it's a relatively significant drop there. The bigger drop comes because a lot of what the counties and local taxing districts who rely on the revenues see is what we actually accomplish for what we call cutout on a timber sale. So we go and we sell a certain amount that we appraise. But like I said, purchasers often don't harvest that right up front. And while they're not harvesting, it's growing. And we get paid on what's actually delivered to the mill. It's not a cash sale. It's a per thousand board foot price. So if it sits there and grows, we're making money too. That and a few other things that really have to do with exactly how you do the logging, how you merchandise the trees into logs in terms of our appraisal versus what actually happens. We have what's called about a 10% overrun on average on our timber sales. And what that means is we actually realize about 10% more volume than we planned on. Which is great. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And none of them are, you know, none of them are hiding the ball at all or anything like that. It's just how these things go. Like I said, it's mostly due to growth and how the logs get merchandised, I would say, are the two primary factors. Like I said, we plan 215 million board feet, but what we actually end up harvesting on that same area is closer to 239 million average over the last 10 years. So we see that 10% bump. So what's unknown when we talk about the 183, 185 or so million feet that we plan now under the HCP strategies has yet to be seen if we're going to see a similar result in terms of the cutout. And so so we got to compare the right numbers to the right numbers when we're talking about these.
How does a timber sale normally work? Do you identify an area where you think it's ripe for harvest or ready for harvest, and then companies bid on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, and maybe I'll start with that just real fundamental piece. When we sell a timber sale, we've identified an area, we've posted a boundary, we've already taken into account all the resource concerns and all that kind of stuff, and it's ready to bid. We put it up for auction and we sell it to the highest bidder. And then that purchaser is responsible. We have a pretty thick timber sale contract that has a lot of stipulations in it, right? To make sure things are done the way we want. And we administer the progress of it as it goes along and provide any correction necessary. But the purchaser, which is typically a mill, will then hire operators to go out and harvest that timber. And the purchaser decides exactly when in the contract window they're going to do the things like building the roads and all of the other work that they have to do to go in and harvest the timber. So a lot of times the first year or two of the timber sale contract, they'll be, you know, figuring out when scheduling their road building and doing all of that. And oftentimes it's not until later in the contract period that they actually do the harvesting. But for all of those activities, we have contract administrators who go out and check and make sure that all of the things that are being done, the road building and all the other things are harvesting and everything are being done to specifications of the contract. And I would say, you know, we have a really good relationship with our purchasers, and we have, you know, we've worked with a lot of purchasers for a very long time. They understand our contract specifications. They understand our timber sale administration. And so we have a really good working relationship, and we have, you know, relatively few problems out there in the actual how the work is actually conducted.
Is it because you're going to be setting more acreage aside for conservation that there is less available than for harvest? Is that the connection?
Yes, that's right. And so putting up at a little bit higher planning level, when we're trying to select all the timber sale candidates that will eventually become those sales that we auction, what we have various constraints even under our current forest management plan out there on the landscape, things that are logistical. There are areas that we simply cannot log. It's just not feasible because generally they're too steep, those areas. But then there's also a lot of other considerations. Even in our current plan, we have a landscape design where we are trying to facilitate the development of forests that are essentially providing habitat function for species that like older forests. And so we take all these things, all these limitations, and we are left with what's called available acres. Right, acres available for harvest. In that, there are areas where we typically, well, stands are in different age classes. Typically, we have an age class where we would conduct a clear cut, a final harvest, somewhere between 70 and 90 years old. It depends on the site and how fast the trees grow. Trees sort of culminate and start to slow their growth at a certain point. And it's hard to hit that precisely, but we basically try and, get in there and harvest for production reasons. We get in there and harvest when they're on that curve starts to slow down. We also do other operations along the way, though, like commercial thinning, that is intended to enhance that growth and make sure that growth continues. So that's typically been where for a long time where we've been at, probably somewhere in that 70 to 90 year old range. You'll see those stands that grow really fast on really high sites. We'll harvest them earlier in their 60s. But we've never really been what we call truly short rotation forestry. And we also haven't been terribly long rotation forestry. We've always been sort of in that middle. But basically, the stands that are, going to be coming online are the ones that are candidates for harvest, and we select from those. And that's just generally how we do the planning piece of it.
We've been talking about the Habitat Conservation Plan with Mike Wilson, the division chief in charge of the state forests for the Oregon Department of Forestry. There's a lot more to know about the HCP, and we'll broadcast part two of this program on Monday, June 10th at 9:30 a.m. If you miss either part, you can always listen to the podcast of the program after broadcast at kmun.org. This is The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucka.